From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Mark Report. It's the 25th day of September, 2008. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's in Decatur, Illinois. In agricultural news, Washington is edging closer to a bailout plan for Wall Street, and Farmer Mac says bad investments in Fannie Mae and the collapse of Lehman Brothers are having a big impact on its bottom line. We'll have details of these and other stories shortly. And the president of the Missouri Botanical Gardens will join us to discuss biodiversity of plants around the globe. At the end of this half hour, meteorologist Peter Levitt will join us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. It all happens, of course, on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of WILL Public Radio from the University of Illinois.
The Closing Market Report is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at agrigold.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago, on this Thursday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. December wheat at 736 and a quarter, 6 cents higher. The March at 756 and a half, up 5 3/4. And May wheat futures at 770 and a half, 5 1/2 cents higher. December corn, 558 and a quarter, down 4 3/4. The March at 576, 4 1/2 cents lower. And May futures at 587 and a quarter, down a nickel. July corn, 596 and a quarter, 4 3/4 lower on the afternoon. November beans, $11.83, down 4. January at 11.99 and a half, 4 1/4 lower. And the March futures at 12.12 and a half, down a nickel. May contract, 12.24 and a half, 5 cents lower. October bean meal at 323.40, down 4.20. October bean oil at 47.77, 7 higher on the day. October live cattle, $100.95, $1.22 and a half lower. December futures there at 102.62 and a half, down $1.57 and a half. September feeder cattle at 107.87 and a half, 17 and a half cents higher in the October futures at $106.85 a hundredweight in the feeder cattle pit. Finished 75 cents lower. October lean hogs, $69.27 a hundredweight, up 32 1/2 cents, but the December futures were off a dime. They settled this Thursday afternoon at $66.12 at the CME Group. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a production of Public Radio on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason. In a moment, we'll talk with Dan Zwicker. Here's what the outside markets look like in New York and other places this afternoon. November crude oil futures at $107 are down, or rather up $1.27 at this hour, but the December contract at $103.80 is down $1.22. October ethanol futures at $2.25 and 4 cents, down 1 1/10 for the day. Natural gas trading at $7.70 is up 2 1/10. The October gasoline for the RBOB at 268 and 8 tenths is 9 and 3 tenths higher, and the heating oil is trading at $3.02 and 9 tenths of a cent for the October. That's a penny and 6 tenths of a cent higher on the day. Propane futures at $1.56 are down a penny, and the gold futures are trading the nearby September contract at $877.70, down $11.30. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now stands at 11,019, just about 194 points higher, and the U.S. dollar is trading at 77.08. That's up 0.08 for the afternoon. The CRB index trading at 367.86 is up 1.42, and the Goldman Sachs at 665 is up 8 points for the day. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like. Mostly clear skies tonight. Lows generally between 50 and 55. A bit warmer near Lake Michigan. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. The highs will range from 80 in northern and eastern parts of Indiana to 87 in the southwestern parts of Illinois. Dry weather expected in most areas on Saturday. A few showers might back into the eastern part of Indiana from the east on Saturday. A few widely scattered showers may occur Saturday night into Sunday, but amounts and coverage are expected to remain very, very low.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Stuart Peterson. For over 20 years, Stuart Peterson has helped farmers manage both marketing opportunities and risks through their analysis, advice, and action. Stuart Peterson, confidence like never before. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
On a Thursday afternoon, time to take a look at the agricultural markets, and Dan Zwicker is along to help us through that process, as he is each and every Thursday. He's with ADM's Grain Group, based in Decatur, Illinois. Hi, Dan.
How you doing, Todd?
I'm very well. Been
good.
Busy all day here on the air. Hosted a lot of programming, but back to my favorite. Ready to talk with you about what's been happening in the marketplace. You want to start with the grains today for me?
Let's say noisy.
Okay. So do you want to start with the outside markets instead?
Well, I'm not too sure what's tied to what. Let's put it that way. It's, I think, of course, you know, the main focus has been what may or may not happen on Capitol Hill and in the $700 billion bailout. And I guess at least going through the day here, it looks like they're almost there, or at least the market in New York thinks they're there. We're up a couple hundred points, but you know, kind of as I mentioned to Dave this morning, you know, we're well seasoned at this business about buying the rumor and selling the news. So come Monday morning, it may be a little different story. So that's something to kind of watch out on. I think when you go backwards into the ag commodities, you know, beans had a pretty firm day, pretty well all the way to the end, and now we finished down here about 4 or 5 cents. Corn kind of struggled through most of the day. A lot of that, I think, is driven by a weak outlook on export demand. Our export sales may have been a little better than what we've seen most recently, but there's just not a lot of interest in wanting to own commodities in the export market. I think a lot of them still have some expensive inventory to work off from the summer months. And then, of course, the uncertainty in the financial situation is also making them a little slow. So export demand is definitely a drag on the market here. The other factor is I think everybody's a little uncertain and scratching their head what's going to happen on ethanol grind with, your number one and number two ethanol companies or your major ethanol companies kind of in financial straits at the moment anyway, with one having hedge losses large enough to make their grind, their corn grind is going to cost them $6.50 a bushel of corn, how they're going to make that one work. And then we've got another ethanol chain that has kind of run out of money, that they've lost their financing. So everybody's kind of watching that on the domestic front to see whether or not that's going to maybe end up dragging down the ethanol grind for the picture. So we're struggling with demand. And, of course, on top of that, you know, the combines are starting to roll. Nothing really big time yet, but we are beginning to hear a few yields coming out of the Midwest here. Kind of a mixed bag, I would say, generally speaking, and it's hard to say too much at the moment, but the corn yields, at least in Illinois, look like they're coming in underneath a year ago levels, fairly consistent. And, of course, the Illinois yield is one yield that USDA did not lower on their last report. So that kind of tells me maybe the corn crop might be getting a little smaller. But if we lose it on the demand side, it doesn't make a lot of difference. Soybeans, not much to report. We are hearing a few bean fields coming in, kind of a mixed bag in there. I still think we need another couple weeks, and we're going to start hearing a lot of yield activity. But this is the time of year where it's real hard to get the market to go up right in front of harvest. Traders don't really want to buy the market in front of harvest. And then when you add the financial uncertainty to the complex, that just kind of drags on the market altogether, Todd.
Boy, I tell you, the export markets are demand there is waning. Ethanol, where we put something like a quarter or a third of the crop in trouble in some respects. Not a pretty picture that you paint this afternoon for corn.
Well, it's negative, but remember the market adjusts to those factors, and this just might be the time we're kind of working the negative side. Next week we may be wanting to work the positive side, but the market is, and still trying to get a handle on that size of crop. We have some consulting firms out there that are just still very animate about the fact that the national average yield of corn is 156 bushels per acre versus what USDA is looking at. So that makes people a little hesitant to be a buyer. Of course, the other news on the demand front is Pilgrim's Pride, the number one poultry producer in the United States, is in financial straits, cash flow problems, stock down at a 52-week low in here. Demand is and I think, it's all part of what's happening on Wall Street. Capital is drying up. Capital's hard to get, and I think, is kind of indicating that longer term here, even if we get ourselves through the Wall Street crunch right at the moment, overall lenders are going to be much more stricter and money may be harder to come by, that is not going to be a really good sign for a growing demand or a growing economy.
Well, the Pilgrim's Pride thing reminds me that the Texas governor had called on a rollback for the ethanol mandate and said that it was doing harm to the economy. I'm wondering whether that might rear its ugly head again if and maybe you can talk a little bit about this, how much impact you really think the grind for ethanol has had in the marketplace in terms of the movement upward. Everything comes up with that? It was a demand all across the board at that point. Was it outside market influences that pushed the market sharply higher? What conditions brought us to where we are?
Well,
today?
I think it's a combination. I mean, demand was a key force in this market. Growing demand, whether it's you can attribute it to the biofuel sector, I mean, definitely that was a big key factor in lifting prices higher. The other thing is we had a great year for exports this past year with the weaker dollar. So you combine good domestic demand with good export demand, a growing world economy. I mean, when you combined all three of those things together, that is the key factor that lifted these prices sharply higher. But I mean, there's nothing in the rule book here that says that end users can't protect themselves from higher prices. I mean, the tools are available for end users to manage their risk. That's all we talk about here on WILLL is producers managing their risk.
Mm-hmm.
There are tools available to manage downside price risk from the producer's point of view. But the end users, in some ways, I think the producers are further along on managing their risk than a lot of these end users. I think are a little bit behind the eight ball, and farmers are further ahead, which is, I think, a compliment to the ag community of pushing education and information, down to the farmer level for him to understand and try to use the tools to manage his risk. Whereas I think end users kind of fell asleep at the switch, thinking that $2.25 corn and $6 soybeans were going to be here forever, and all of a sudden the prices start climbing, and they kind of froze, so to speak, and didn't know what to do about it, and they let their costs get away from them, and I think that's some of the repercussions what we're seeing, you know, on the demand side.
Well, how would you manage downside risk now if you're sitting on the combine harvesting corn and soybeans this fall, and you have crop insurance in place?
Well, crop insurance is a separate issue. I know people like to view crop insurance as kind of a blanket put. I don't necessarily like to view it that way, but, you know, everybody has their own viewpoint of that. I think it's mostly a, you know, like an insurance policy if, you know, based upon a catastrophic loss, it's there to kind of pick up the slack. And crop insurance is no substitute for marketing. You still have to market your grain. And I think, you know, at least from what I see in the commodity complex here, there is some downside risk here, but I think at this point, if I was a farmer and I, you know, didn't have a whole lot sold, or I had enough sold to kind of meet what I was going to sell out of the field and not have to pay storage and this kind of stuff, I'd probably be patient in here to see if we could get kind of a fall bounce. I still think the market is going to, at some point in time, try to wrestle with corn acres. I don't think we have the corn acres on the books that we need for the 2009 crop. And I think ultimately that will begin to take hold at some point in time. It should maybe lift corn futures up to give us a little better sale than what we currently have.
Dan, thanks for being with us.
Very well.
Dan Zwickers with ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois, joins us on the Closing Market Report on a Thursday afternoon.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Dave Dickey is here now with a look at today's agricultural news.
In agricultural news, lawmakers and the Bush administration are edging closer to agreement on a $700 billion bailout plan to rescue Wall Street. The deal reportedly has additional protections for taxpayers and new help for distressed homeowners. A bipartisan meeting between the president and lawmakers is scheduled this afternoon. Farmer Mac, a federally chartered ag lender that resells pools of farm loans on Wall Street, says sour investments in Fannie Mae and the now bankrupt Lehman Brothers could drain an estimated $92 million from the lender's capital base. The loss represents about 15% of its investment portfolio, but about one-third of its capital base, leaving it significantly below its statutory capital requirement. Federal Credit Administration officials say the exact amount of the shortfall is not public knowledge, but that Farmer Mac has viable options to address the situation. The latest numbers say that the U.S. is exporting three times more diesel fuel to Europe than a year ago. The Energy Information Administration reports that Europe imported 119,000 barrels of diesel fuel per day from the U.S. in the first half of the year. Expect the Senate Agriculture Committee to address the issue of child obesity on several legislative fronts next year. Senate Agriculture Committee Chairman Tom Harkin says he will make childhood obesity a major focus of the reauthorization of the child nutrition programs in 2009, and that reduction of child obesity should be part of any legislative overhaul of health care. The Senate yesterday approved $18 billion in energy tax credits for using renewable sources, including wind, solar, and geothermal. To cover the costs of the tax incentives, the oil industry would have to pay higher taxes. And USDA says it sees merit in a petition by the American Meat Institute to allow beef producers to irradiate whole carcasses to help prevent against E. coli bacteria. while at the same time avoiding federal rules that require retail labels. Under Food and Drug Administration regulations, processing aids that are present in the finished food at insignificant levels do not need to be made known to consumers. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming at WILL, Public Radio for the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of this Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report on most of these radio stations. In the second half hour of our program today, we'll talk with Peter Raven. He is the president of the Missouri Botanical Gardens, and we'll discuss biodiversity in plant life around the planet. That all comes up during the second half hour of the Closing Market Report. In today's Listener Opinion Forum, Shelby County Farm Bureau's Amy Rochkus says farming safely is an investment.
As agriculture continues to rank as one of the most dangerous occupations in North America and across the globe, the National Safety Council will put the spotlight on the farming and the related health and safety issues September 21st through the 27th. This year marks the 65th year of the National Safety Council's focus on agricultural safety. The theme for 2008 is Farm Safely, Protect Your Investment. This theme highlights the value of the safety and wellness of the agricultural producer and the importance of protecting hearing, lung function, vision, skin, and the musculoskeletal system. How safe are you on your farm? Illinois farm-related deaths in 2007-2008 totaled 29, compared to 22 deaths in the previous year. According to Country Financial, the number of deaths is the lowest it has been since 2002. Farm accidents resulting in death are not only a tragedy, but severely impact the lives of families involved. That's why Country Financial participates annual in the National Farm Safety and Health Week. Country wants to increase farm safety awareness to reduce farm-related deaths and injuries, as well as financial losses for farm families. Injuries on the farm also impact families. Farmers usually lose 4 days of work for every injury suffered. They are at high risk for both fatal and non-fatal injuries, including work-related lung diseases, noise-induced hearing loss, skin diseases, and certain cancers associated with chemical use and prolonged sun exposure. There are many safety precautions farmers can take to minimize their risk of being injured or killed. They include installing rollover protective structures, entering grain bins properly, and monitoring farm equipment consistently. Farmers are reminded of these tips. To learn more about how you can play it safe on the farm, check out the Farm Safety and Health Week website at the National Farm Safety Council. This is Amy Rochkus with the Shelby County Farm Bureau.
Amy Rochkus' comments are her own and reflect her opinions. They do not necessarily reflect those of this station. We strongly urge listeners like you to become involved by sharing your views as well. To do so, just give us a call at 217-333-0850. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a production of Public Radio on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm your host, Todd Gleason. Coming up in the second half hour of our program on most of these radio stations, we'll talk with Peter Raven. He is the president of the Missouri Botanical Gardens and a botanist at Washington University. We'll discuss plant biology with him. That'll happen in the second half hour on most of these radio stations in just a few moments, a couple of minutes, actually. Peter Lavitt will join us, agricultural meteorologist, to take a complete look at the world of agricultural weather here in the Midwest, around the nation, and around the planet.
With this look at AM 580 News, I'm Tom Rogers. The Illinois Department of Corrections spent more than $400,000 for an independent study of the prison system's needs. Now, after sitting on the report for a year, the agency says it doesn't agree with the findings. The Peoria architectural firm that conducted the study concluded Illinois would need space for more than 2,700 additional inmates by 2016. The firm also concluded that a prison in Pontiac that Governor Rob Blagojevich wants to close could be upgraded for less than $6 million. Department of Corrections spokesman Derek Schnapp says the study is wrong. It didn't take into account programs designed to keep freed inmates from committing more crimes. The unemployment rates in Champaign-Urbana, Bloomington-Normal, and three other metropolitan areas in the state have hit their highest level since 1990. The August state figures show a 6.6% unemployment rate for Champaign-Urbana, up from only 4.9% in August of last year. At the same time, the area lost 600 jobs over the past year. The proposed federal bailout of the financial industry does not have the vote of an East Central Illinois congressman. Republican Tim Johnson says despite reports of bipartisan compromise on the principle behind a $700 billion plan, he remains suspicious of it. Johnson says he voted against previous federal bailout proposals for other firms and resents that taxpayers should pay for their mistakes of what he calls Wall Street money changers. A memo from the University of Illinois over political involvement is riling employees. The memo from the U of I's ethics office says employees cannot wear or distribute anything on campus that supports a particular candidate or party. It also interprets the rules as not allowing employees to appear at any rallies for political candidates on campus. U of I President Joseph White says the rule forbids employees from using school resources for political means, but he also says the university won't police employees' activities and advises them to use common sense. And shareholders of William Wrigley have approved the chewing gum maker's $23 billion sale to candy maker Mars, creating the world's largest confection maker. I'm Tom Rogers, AM 580 News.
I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a production of Public Radio here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. On a Thursday afternoon, Pete Leavitt joins us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Good afternoon to you, Pete.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Weather here in the Midwest going to be good for harvesting?
Oh, it's going to be beautiful. We finally have a period where we can look for not only a lack of precipitation with only a chance of a few very light showers here and there, but above normal temperatures as well. We don't have any rain in sight, any significant rain in sight, right in through next week. There's a little a frontal system that's going to come by around late Monday or Tuesday, but I don't think there's enough moisture with that to create more than a few sprinkles, maybe a few heavier showers in the extreme northern areas of the Midwest crop belt. But beautiful weather. This is just what you've been waiting for, and this is what you're finally looks like you're going to enjoy.
Yeah, warm weather too, right?
Yes, it is. Temperatures above normal. We're in the 80s today. We'll see the 80s again or just get in there tomorrow. And maybe a little bit cooler, but daytime temperatures well up in the 70s, if not hitting the 80-degree mark in northern Illinois, and low temperatures only getting down to about 50. So no frost, and mild temperatures.
Good harvest weather in the Midwest. How about sowing weather if we get into the hard red winter wheat belt?
Moisture has not been a problem there this season. As a matter of fact, it's been the opposite, except in a few places in extreme western portions of the belt. I think they're in for an open week as well. There's no precipitation forecast for the southern plains, and temperatures will be close to normal, maybe a little cooler than normal, but that's not a problem for seeding.
And if you take a look around the rest of the planet, maybe start with China. They're in the middle of harvest season.
Yeah, and they're having good weather there in China for harvesting. It's been favorable. Shower activity has been rather light in the areas that our crops are maturing, and the temperatures have been moderate. No problems there. Even in the Argentine, where you've heard me talk about so many times how dry it is on their new crop coming along, it's springtime down there. They finally got a little rain in the Argentine, so things are looking a little brighter there.
And further to the north of that country in Brazil was awfully warm this week.
Yes, well, it's going to cool off up in there, but it's also they had some showers earlier this past week, and they're going to get a showery week this week, and they could use the showers now. They need some more moisture to get the spring crops planted.
And finally, if you talk a little bit about the wheat crop maybe in Ukraine and Australia, and we have just a few seconds left.
Okay. Australia's had intermittent moisture a lot better than they have had in some of the recent years. I think they're off to a reasonably good opportunity to get new crop going down there in Australia for their summer crops, and their winter harvest should have no problem.
Now, we appreciate you being with us this afternoon.
Yes, my pleasure.
Thanks much. That's Peter Levitt. He joins us on the Closing Market Report on a Thursday afternoon in just a few moments. We'll continue our conversation this afternoon on most of these radio stations when Peter Raven of the Missouri Botanical Garden will join us to discuss biological diversity around the planet. I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report. It's a Thursday afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason. We're talking today with Peter Raven over the next 25 minutes, a botanist at Washington University and president of the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis. Dr. Raven, thanks for being on the show. And can you tell me how you came to be the president of the Missouri Botanical Garden? What was the path that you took?
Our founder, Henry Shaw, who opened this garden, which is the oldest in the United States, in 1859, set it up during the 30 years he ran the garden so that the professor of botany at Washington University would be head of the garden. And that meant that the head of the garden here is always an academic. The first one, incidentally, was William Trelease, who went on then, after 23 years here, to U of I and had quite a distinguished career there as head of the botany department. Trelease Hall there is named after him.
Well, this Missouri Botanical Garden is probably familiar to many of our listeners. I would suspect several, like me, have been there. It is an awe-inspiring garden, but maybe you could take us for a quick walk through it today.
We have 79 acres here when our founder opened the garden in 1859, and we're looking forward to our 150th anniversary next year. It was 3 miles outside of the city, which ended at 18th Street, on the prairies, near his country house. He didn't open it as an estate. He opened it for the public from the beginning, just before the Civil War. And it's lasted to the present as an operating trust under the governance of a board of trustees. Now, in the last 30 to 40 years, in the time I've been here, the whole 79 acres have been developed so that we have a Japanese garden, 15-acre Japanese garden, 8.5-acre home gardening demonstration center, Chinese garden, an Ottoman garden, which we just opened, an English woodland garden, and many, many different styles of landscape architecture here, and of course our well-known half-acre geodesic dome, the Climatron, which has tropical plants from all over the world, which was finished in 1960. We have three other public facilities in the St. Louis area, an Earthways Center, which deals with sustainability, the Sophia Sachs Butterfly House, and which is out in St. Louis County, and then a 2,400-acre nature reserve 35 miles away in the foothills of the Ozarks along I-44. We have about 800,000 visitors a year, about 130,000 children taking classes, and it's a very lovely display, and of course it's a very lovely research institution as well.
Maybe you could talk a bit more about the research side as opposed to the loveliness of these gardens and why it's important that they're where they are located in St. Louis, if there is any specific reason for that, or for there to be such diversity within the gardens.
The reason it's located in St. Louis is simply that's where our founder got it going. We have the diversity here because of an overt intention to promote internationalism and an international outlook here in St. Louis. We have about, as a research organization, we have about 50 PhDs on the staff and about 100 people supporting them. And some of our staff is living in Paris, in Chicago, in London, in Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Madagascar. We have about 60 staff members on the island of Madagascar, all but one of whom are Malagasy. And then we have a program in Vietnam. So we're active worldwide. The two major similar institutions are the New York Botanical Garden and the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew near London. We're all engaged in plant inventory around the world. We differ. some of our distinctive characteristics are that we have people actually stationed all over the world, finding out about the kinds of plants and applying that knowledge to conservation and sustainability in many different countries.
I've traveled the globe a bit, and it seems to me that while there is a great deal of diversity in plant life, there is a great deal of sameness in plant life. For instance, if you travel to Ukraine, you find trees that look similar. The weed species are the same, and the crops are very much the same. How much diversity is there on our planet from one end to the other, north to south?
You know, the diversity is greater as you move from north to south and as you move from east to west. And as Jared Diamond points out in his book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, where he's talking about the dispersal of crops around the northern hemisphere, one of the reasons that agriculture spread across Eurasia so easily is it spread at the same latitude. In the north temperate region, there are about 18,000 species of plants in the U.S. and Canada. About 40% of them are found only here, but many of the genera, like oaks and birches and willows and so forth, are all around the northern hemisphere, but probably with different species. Compared to the roughly 18,000 kinds in the U.S. and Canada, there are about 11,500 in Europe and about 31,500 in China, which basically has both retained more archaic kinds of plants and animals than the other two areas for historical geological reasons, and also had a great deal of the development of new species on the many mountain ranges in China. Not very many people realize that 40% of China is above 6,000 feet elevation. So there are many, many mountain ranges there, and each one tends to have its distinctive biological diversity.
So that's the geological side of why there are so many different species
there.
Well,
why it's common around the northern hemisphere. Then if you go south, to get directly onto your question, about two-thirds of all the species of plants and animals live in the tropics, and in general those would be different from those found either north or south. And, of course, in the southern hemisphere, the temperate regions are separated from one another by very wide stretches of ocean, so that the plants and animals in South Africa, southern South America, and Australia and New Zealand all differ quite a bit from one another. They're all somewhat isolated from one another. But as I say, about two-thirds of the diversity, and by far the least well-known parts of the diversity, are in the tropics.
Are you concerned at all the diversity of plant life around the globe is narrowing?
Oh, it's definitely narrowing as a result of habitat destruction. Well over half of all the tropical forests in Southeast Asia are gone now, and people are hammering away at it in Africa and in South America. And it seems likely to me and to many of my colleagues that half probably of all the biological diversity on Earth is in danger of extinction during this century. Another factor that's, of course, emerged as being of great importance is global warming, because a lot of the habitats where plants and animals grow now, and an obvious example would be mountains near the southern ends of those lands that I listed in the southern hemisphere, a lot of those habitats are simply disappearing. In the United States, there will be no real area above timberline by the end of this century by any climate change model, no alpine habitats, no Arctic tundra, and of course the plants and animals that live there either will have to accommodate themselves to relatively open places like rocky slopes that are below timberline now, or they'll simply disappear from the lower 48 states. So there's a huge amount of extinction going on, and as that extinction goes on, the world is becoming less and less rich biologically and less diverse. And, of course, with that lowered amount of genetic diversity is a lowered potential for replenishing natural communities or for finding the kinds of genetic diversity that can be used to increase agricultural productivity or other desired characteristics.
Well, I suppose, and this is a question that's kind of strange, I guess, but that would be replenishing quickly. But replenishing over time shouldn't be terribly hard to do.
No, but we're probably talking about tens of millions
right.
of years, and since the average life of a species of mammal, which is what we are, is about 2 million years, and we're at about 2 million years now, waiting around for 20 million years may well not be an option.
Well, it doesn't sound like it's an awfully good option.
Well, it's an awfully philosophical point of view.
Yeah.
We probably would want to take more practical action.
Well, what kind of practical action should be taken? And maybe let's deal, for instance, with destruction of lands or clearing of lands for agricultural uses. What kinds of things are practical applications? I have one from the governor of Mato Grosso, Maggi. He has an idea. Maybe you've got some, too. Governor Maggi, in an interview that I had done with him a year and a half ago, suggested that the world should pay he and his fellow farmers not to destroy parts of the forest lands in Mato Grosso or the rainforest, and that because they own those lands, the world, if they wanted to salvage them, had the right or the ability to go ahead and keep them from destroying them.
Carbon sequestration, of course, keeping carbon dioxide from entering the atmosphere, which thus avoids global warming, is one reason that people are beginning to pay for those rights. In the tropics, there's a market in carbon and locked up carbon that is used as a balance for emitting carbon, both in Chicago and in London. And people are coping now with how to value tropical forests and other forest resources for those purposes. It is logical, it's perfectly logical to do what the governor of Mato Grosso said, which is to pay for saving biological diversity as well, but we haven't quite gotten to that point. The world is, of course, notoriously composed of haves and have-nots, and in countries like the United States, we haven't gotten used to the idea of handing out money to people in developing countries to improve their lot. We tend to keep it here. It's the United States has 4.5% of the world's people and 25% of the world's economy, which shows itself as first approximation that we depend on sustainability in countries all over the world to flourish. And if we don't pay more attention to that, we'll be suffering the consequences. Obviously, your end of the boat is sinking is not a workable formula now, if it ever was. So it's a perfectly logical suggestion, but when we find it difficult to deal with poor or disadvantaged people, even in our own communities, it's going to take a lot of changed attitude to begin to deal effectively with poor or disadvantaged people or the preservation of biological diversity around the world. I hope we'll get to that point, but I don't know when.
Would it be advisable to allow landowners here in the United States to set aside those lands and try to sequester carbon on farmlands?
Oh, I think so. And one of the things that a lot of people are wondering about now is which agricultural systems sequester the most carbon.
Right.
Of course, our reserve lands are getting planted up now pretty ferociously in the struggle to generate biofuels. But provided that we've worked through those things, I absolutely do think that it's very logical to pay farmers for locking up carbon also.
This is the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report, a production of WILL Public Radio from the University of Illinois. Our guest today is Dr. Peter Raven. He's a botanist at Washington University and president of the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2444.
Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like for Illinois and Indiana, says Chief Meteorologist Ed Kieser. Tonight, skies should be mostly clear. Lows will generally range between 50 and 55. A bit warmer near Lake Michigan and in some of the city centers. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. Highs will range from 80 in northern and eastern Indiana to 87 in the southwestern part of Illinois. The extended forecast says dry weather will be expected in most areas on Saturday. A few showers might back into the eastern parts of Indiana from the east on Saturday. A cold front expected to pass through the two-state area Monday afternoon and evening. And that should trigger a few scattered showers on Monday afternoon through Tuesday. Then mostly dry weather will return on Wednesday, although a few pop-up afternoon showers could be expected in parts of Indiana. Temperatures will turn significantly cooler for a few days, with below average readings expected Tuesday night through Thursday night of next week. Highs on Wednesday, the coldest day, will only be in the upper 50s and 60s, and lows on Thursday, the coldest morning, will be in the mid-30s to the mid-40s. Some of the normally coldest spots may see a touch of frost, but a widespread frost or freeze is not expected.
Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation on the U of I campus. McKinley is active in addressing issues of social justice and offers education for all ages. Committed to inclusiveness, McKinley welcomes all. On the web at www.mckinley-church.org.
You're listening to the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason. Our guest is Dr. Peter Raven of the Missouri Botanical Garden. When we left, we were talking about carbon sequestration. Dr. Raven, does it really work?
Yes. How much it works? I mean, there's far more carbon in the soil worldwide than there is in plants. And how well we can capture that and what we need to do to protect it, one of the obvious things being no-till, is something that people need to work through very thoroughly and in a variety of different circumstances. But yes, it certainly works. You know, how much and what the value is are things that we've yet got to agree on. I need to say that increasing agricultural productivity on the lands that are already being cultivated is one of the best strategies for being able to protect biological diversity in lands that are not cultivated. And conversely, low output, low production agriculture is a very bad strategy for protecting anything, as is, for example, widespread grazing animals on natural pastures, because most of that is unsustainable.
This causes me to ask the next question. How much involvement does the botanical garden or support does it get from Monsanto?
We get support, but we're not doing any particular. We're not doing any joint research, and we're not doing research that has any direct relationship to one another. Now, we and Monsanto and Washington University founded the Donald Danforth Plant Research Center, which University of Illinois is a partner in, but it's an independent organization with an independent board that is trying to do, that is doing basic research in plant biology intended to improve agricultural productivity. But as I say, it's its own institution. And as I also said, we get support from the Monsanto, but so do all the cultural institutions in St. Louis, and we have no common research programs. Washington University and the Danforth Center do have research programs that are supported by Monsanto, but at a pretty arm's length way.
Let's talk a bit about the Danforth Center, if we could, for
yes.
a time being.
Mm-hmm.
This was a center that was established in the late 90s and I think opened in 2002 or thereabouts.
Was established in 1999 because 1998 because
right.
It's celebrating its 10th anniversary now, and the building opened, yes, probably in 2002.
Right. And this was termed, I think, to be the mecca of genetic modification
areas.
And
no.
Plant.
Well,
Well, go ahead.
Plant exploration, I suppose, might be a better term. Has it been succeeding?
It was intended to be and has been a place where one works on basic plant molecular and cellular biology in order to make possible advances in agricultural productivity, but also to learn about the basic biology in focused ways, for example, root biology, drought resistance to some extent, and similar properties of plants, how those are facilitated or how those come about at a molecular and cellular level. And yes, a number of research groups have been formed there within the Danforth Center, which have been very successful in scientific advances, in making scientific advances in some of those fields. And after 10 years of operation, the center is coming to a kind of maturity and, of course, cooperates a lot with the four university partners that it has.
Those are the University of Illinois, Missouri.
Purdue, the University of Missouri, Purdue. Columbia. I guess there are only three.
Yeah, I was thinking that Iowa State might be involved, but
well,
I don't
know. Well, we wanted
recall.
Them to be. We wanted them to be, but that never worked out. It's perfectly open, but we've been busy consolidating our relationships with Illinois, Purdue, and Mizzou in between, and so not trying hard to add Iowa State. But obviously Iowa State is the logical additional partner. Those are the four strongest agricultural institutions in the middle Midwest.
Well, our time is flying by quickly. Anything we haven't covered, we've got maybe a couple of minutes left, that you want to make sure that we talk about today?
Just to emphasize again that the garden's work is very much to develop the capability of countries around the world to understand the properties of their own plants. And we have a great deal of training and a great many resident scientists out there doing it. And by doing that, we are emissaries of St. Louis and the Midwest and the United States, and we're helping to attain sustainability in various ways. We look for ways to intelligently preserve natural habitats and natural communities. We look for ways for rural people in the countries where we're active to be able to sustain themselves better through growing food for themselves, for example, much as you might do in inner city programs here. Sometimes to make products like baskets and things that can be sold, because basically, without options, many of the people around the world have nothing to do but turn to the forest and consume it. And we'd like to give them options. If you consume your resource on a one-time basis, then you have nothing to turn to when it's all over.
It's certainly a noble mission, and we thank you for leading the Missouri Botanical Garden as its president and for bringing all of those wonderful plants to St. Louis for us to get to easily. Thank you very much, Dr. Raven.
People will come see them, and thank you very much.
Dr. Peter Raven is the president of the Missouri Botanical Garden. I'm Todd Gleason.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts.